In working towards STD prevention, it has sometimes been difficult to talk fully about sexuality, including a focus on desire and arousal. And there are doubtless many reasons for this, including our somewhat puritanical cultural history. There are also political issues that we all are aware of. Even a mild, slightly positive mention of masturbation has in the past cost someone her job. The ascendance of abstinence-only until marriage programs has probably made this worse, made us have a more difficulty talking about sexuality fully. But even comprehensive sex ed guidelines have been reticent in the ways that they talk about sexuality as well. And I took a look in the CICAS guidelines for comprehensive sex ed for, just did a search for the word arousal, and these are the only two places that that term shows up in that report. Men get erections and women experience vaginal lubrication during sexual arousal. That's pretty hard to argue with, that's just a basic fact. And orgasm is an intense, pleasurable release of sexual feelings or tension experienced at the peak of sexual arousal. And the word desire also is not mentioned very often. Although sexual desires occur throughout life, are natural, but then don't worry, they do not need to be acted upon necessarily. So we're somewhat reticent in the ways that we talk about sexuality in this full way, but in contrast, the broader culture does not share that reticence. Images like this are prevalent. Even pictures of athletes. This is a female beach volleyball player in the Summer Olympics, a very sexualized picture. Even politicians. Those are Sarah Palin's legs that we're looking through to see a McCain supporter. Probably remember Miley Cyrus posing at the age of 15 for Vanity Fair, looking, I would say, not too dissimilar from this Candy's shoe ad. And it is mostly white people that we see in the media, in all kinds of media, but people of color are also presented in sexualized ways, such as these examples. And a very recent and egregious example that Joe Valentine sent to me, this is a billboard in New Jersey that I believe is either has been taken down or is coming down due to a public outcry. But this young woman is assisting the man to remove his pants. Her tongue, she's licking her lips or doing something with her tongue, and this is his hand here, possibly caressing her head or maybe pushing it towards him. So a very sexual message in that billboard. So there's a disjunction here, and we, I believe, need to think about how to reconcile that disjunction, especially as we're moving towards a framework of sexual health in our work. And my talk today is meant to jumpstart that conversation, you know, basically just to give you some thoughts and ideas about how to think about this. So my goals are, first, I want to introduce you to the concept of sexualization as outlined by the American Psychological Association Task Force on the Sexualization of Girls, and present to frame that, just to present a broad mediation model. And then I want to provide at the end some examples of a holistic vision of sexual help to get us thinking and hopefully talking about this some more. So the broad model that I work under and that I want to fit this discussion into would be just a sort of an abstract psychological mediation model. So we all are exposed to socializing influences from the media, from other people, and from institutions such as the government or schools. These will lead to or cause changes in the way that we think. So changes in our attitudes, our beliefs, the scripts that we have about sexuality, and those lead to sexual behaviors, such as risky sexual behaviors. And one thing that I want to point out is that we certainly think about particular sexual behaviors as being healthy or not, but these other components as well can be thought of in a health perspective. So these thoughts that we have in our mind, the scripts that we have, our attitudes and our beliefs about sexuality, we can conceptualize those as healthy or not. And for sure, the ways that the media are presenting sexuality and so forth, I would say, can be thought of as healthy or not. So within that model, I want to talk about the concept of sexualization. And this comes from my work on the APA Task Force on the Sexualization of Girls. And if you haven't seen this report and are intrigued by it, from this talk, please do go to the APA website and download it. There's both a full PDF of the report as well as an executive summary. I want to start with the definition of sexualization that the task force came up with. There's a four-part definition. Any one of these four components would be indication that sexualization is present. The first part, value comes primarily from sexual appeal or behavior, if that is the case for a person they are being sexualized. The second part of the definition, there's a narrow standard of what is sexy. Sexy is physically attractive and in a particular, very narrowly defined and difficult to achieve way. Someone is sexualized if they're being sexually objectified, that is made into a passive thing for others to consume, limiting their own possibilities for independent thought and decision making. And finally, sexualization is present if someone is having sexuality imposed on them inappropriately. So let me talk about these just a little bit more and give you some examples. These are some t-shirts that are marketed to girls and teens. One says sexy, the other says boy candy. Shirts like these brand girls as being the only thing important about them is that they're candy for boys to consume and that they're sexy. Even young girls learn this lesson, either in beauty pageants, as the girl at the left is, or the girls at the right are at a Club Libby Lou in DC, where very young girls can pretend to be models and strut in a sexy way down the catwalk. Here's an example of an ad, very common, that gives us a picture of both objectification and the narrow standard that goes along with that. Physically attractive is the definition of what is sexy, but only a certain body type and look is attractive, very thin, white, but with large breasts. It's also an objectifying picture in that the focus is on her body parts, which is there for us to consume. The product name, Addict, and the slogan down here says Admit It, sort of implies that she may be an addict, which makes her vulnerable. Admit It also could potentially mean admit it, you want to have sex. Here's another example that I think illustrates the narrow standard really well. If the photographers had not put these models into bikini bottoms that differed slightly, it would actually be pretty hard to tell them apart. And then down in the corner, we see Maria Sharapova, the tennis star, who's being sexualized as well. Another example from the sports world, this is a picture from the 1999 World Cup Finals. Which you may recall, it was very tense. There was 30 minutes of overtime and then a series of penalty kicks, and Brandi Chastain scored the winning goal for the US team. An incredibly exciting moment. What an academic achievement and an inspiration for young girls everywhere. As male soccer players do, she pulled off her shirt in celebration. Unlike what happens with male soccer players, however, many sportscasters sexualized this action. They refer to it as a strip tease. Now, I don't know about you, but that picture does not look like any strip tease that I've ever seen. She was referred to as the owner of the most talked about breasts in the country, and her fellow teammates were sexualized along with her by being referred to as booters with hooters. So this is a situation, I mean, I'm telling you, Brandi Chastain, I'm sure, was not thinking about sex at the moment that she kicked that winning goal, and nor is she thinking about it in this picture, but that was imposed from outside, and so that is an example of sexualization. The focus of the report was on, particularly on the sexualization of girls, as we see when teen models are made to look very sexy, or adult models are made to look like little girls, but in a sexualized way. Sexy dolls are marketed to very young girls. We got the Bratz dolls and the Bling Bling Barbie there. And this is an example actually from the UK of Bratz marketing bralettes to girls who are like 6 or 7 years old. Really do not need a bra yet, for the most part. Part of the focus of the task force report was to determine the prevalence of sexualization, and just in a nutshell, it's everywhere. Every form of media that was studied, we found sexualization. I'm gonna actually go through these because we're a little bit short on time this morning, but in television, female characters are more likely to be provocatively dressed than males. Music videos have very high levels of sexual content. This is a kind of a notorious example, Nelly's Tip Drill video. But this is true actually across genres, not just hip hop and rap, although they do have many objectifying images, but other studies, any studies that have looked at other genres as well find this. So for example, country music videos, music videos shown on MTV, like the Pussycat Dolls, who have both sexualized outfits and sexualized lyrics. Fewer studies have been done on lyrics, but the ones that have been done show a lot of sexual content and objectifying content with words like bitch and hoe used to describe women. So getting back to the psychological mediation model, I've basically just been telling you a little bit about some of the sexualization that's out there in the media. And the message is, for women, the important thing is to be attractive and sexy. For men, sex and sexual conquest are the important things. Attractive means something very narrow, and women are sexual objects. So where does that lead to? What does that do to the internalized sexuality that's so important from a psychological perspective? I want to introduce you to the concept of self-objectification, which is a crucial concept in thinking about this area. It's based on objectification theory, and the idea of this theory is that through exposure to sexualizing cultural messages, women and girls internalize an objectified third world view of themselves, which includes a constant, sorry, not third person view of themselves, which includes a constant assessment of their attractiveness and whether or not they measure up. They begin to think of their bodies as something to be looked at rather than as something that allows them to do things in the world, and they come to think of themselves as sexual objects rather than as actors. So the sexual socialization and the sexualization and sexual objectification that's out there in the world leads to self-objectification and things that go along with it, like body shame, appearance anxiety, and valuing one's appearance above all other things. And there's a bunch of studies that have shown this, this link from the sexualizing media to the internalized sexuality, the self-objectification, including some meta-analyses that specifically focus on body shame. I'm focusing a lot on the media in this talk, but of course there are many, many other ways that we're socialized sexually, including how other people treat us. And a couple of studies have looked at what happens when other people treat us in a sexually objectifying way, and they have shown that that does lead to self-objectification as well. What about the link to sexual behaviors? That's a topic that's of great interest to us here. Does this self-objectification have any outcome in terms of behaviors, and especially in terms of risky sexual behaviors? Yes, it does. There hasn't been enough studies done yet, but the ones that have been done are very suggestive. So those links between self-objectification and the things that go along with it, like body shame, and diminished sexual health in adolescent girls have been shown. Girls who are higher in self-objectification, who think of their body more in terms of how it looks than in what it can do in the world, are less interested in genital contact and have less sexual experience. That might be okay, except they also have lower use of condoms, and when they do use condoms, they have less confidence about their ability to do so correctly. And also they engage in greater sexual risk-taking. I'm not aware of any studies that have looked at actual STD incidence, but with these sorts of behaviors, you would expect that there would be a greater risk of contracting STDs for those people who are high in self-objectification. There are other aspects of sexual health that have been looked at as well. So self-objectification is associated with less assertiveness about sexual needs. It's associated with less sexual arousal and sexual pleasure. It's also associated with negative attitudes about menstruation and breastfeeding. And I would argue that any definition of sexual health would include a positive experience of these very basic and fundamental bodily functions. We need to learn more about how this particular portrayal of sexuality affects boys and men, but the indications are that it may cause them to rate women, real women, as less attractive, and to have lower relationship and sexual satisfaction. So the possible harms are that boys who learn to objectify women may have difficulty in forming healthy relationships as adults. They may be unable to relate to women in ways other than as sexual objects. And they may learn to see themselves in limited ways relationally, perhaps only as sexual players, which could be a risk factor for STDs for them. Just really quickly, what about sexual minorities? Men can be objectified too, and this may occur more, at least in some gay male cultures, than for straight men. And lesbian sexuality has been sexualized as well by the media and sometimes by women themselves, such as this kiss by Madonna and Britney Spears. We're just beginning to conduct research on these topics, and I'll just maybe skip on through this, but we do need to understand this better as well and not just think about this in terms of straight women and men. And we also need to do more research on other diverse groups, such as other ethnicities and races, the disabled. And social class, I think, is really interesting. It's across the board, is often understudied. But there are many sexual stereotypes about poor people. And these intersect with race as well. So I'd like to see us thinking about that topic more. Okay. So I went through that fast enough now to get to the last part of the talk, a holistic vision of sexual health. It'll give us a chance to really dig in and think about some examples. And I'm not here to have a final definition or a gold standard definition of sexual health by any means. I think that's for all of us to work together to decide on what that is. But I want to give you some examples that I hope will spur your thinking and conversations among us. So I'm going to start with some definitions that you maybe are already familiar with, and then introduce you to some research and thinking that maybe you haven't heard of yet. The WHO has a definition of sexual health that I think is pretty interesting. It's a state of physical, emotional, mental, and social well-being related to sexuality, not merely the absence of disease or dysfunction. Health requires a positive and respectful approach to sexuality. It involves the possibility of having pleasurable sex. So they're putting the word pleasure in there, free of coercion and violence, and sexual rights of all people must be respected. So it's a fairly comprehensive definition. I actually pulled that from the ASHA website, which is newly redesigned to focus on sexual health. And if you haven't had a chance to look at it yet, I encourage you to do so. It's really great. And here they're moving even more from a disease model. So they do say sexual health includes far more than avoiding disease or unplanned pregnancy. But even more, having an STI does not prevent you from being or becoming sexually healthy. So I think that's a different way to think about sexual health than maybe many of us are used to, but one that bears more examination. The CICAS report on comprehensive sex ed has a lot to say about sexual health. I pulled just some of those points out for this slide here. But it involves an appreciation for one's own body, interacting with all genders in a respectful and appropriate way, developing and maintaining meaningful relationships, not exploitative ones, and enjoying one's sexuality and expressing it throughout life in ways that are congruent for one's values. So respect for self and others is key here. Let me take just a couple minutes here to think about the definition of sexualization and whether that helps us to think about what healthy sex might be. In terms of being the opposite of sexualization as defined in that task force report. So one part of that definition of sexualization is that your value comes primarily from your sexual appeal or behavior. In contrast to that, sexual health might be conceptualized as acknowledging and valuing sexuality as one of many aspects of oneself and other people. In sexualization, we're equating sexuality and sexual appeal with a very narrow standard of physical attractiveness. In contrast, sexual health might involve recognizing the myriad ways in which people can be sexy and attractive, including being intelligent, having a sense of humor, having particular values or skills, certain aspects of personality. Thinking more broadly about sexuality and sexual appeal. Sexualization occurs when others are objectified and made into things for someone else to use. In contrast, in sexual health, we would respect the agency and autonomy of each and every person. And in sexualization, we impose sexuality inappropriately on other people. One aspect of sexual health would be that all sexual acts are founded on full and free consent. Okay, so that's the second kind of example of thinking about sexual health. The third example I want to tell you about is some forthcoming research by Lena Bay Chang, who's at SUNY Buffalo, and her colleagues. And she's done some really interesting focus group work with adolescent girls, and I'll tell you just very briefly about that. But one of her underlying messages is that in thinking about sexual health, we have to make space for complexity. We have to be ready to do that. And here are three ways in which she says that's important. So personal responsibility in sexual decisions is, of course, paramount. But we also have to complicate that and remember that social inequities are part of the picture that restrict sometimes individual choice and behavior. Sexuality can serve many goals and is embedded in a larger structure of life, so not looking at it just in a spotlight by itself, but thinking about it more contextually. And this is a really interesting point. Sexual exploration, I would say, necessarily involves some level of risk, yet it is a crucial part of adolescent development and human development. So what is our job for our adolescent boys and girls? Our job is to provide a safe environment for them to do that exploration. In the focus group study that she did, a couple of interesting things reported. She actually has a lot of very rich data, but just very briefly. One of the things that she noted was that when girls were able to talk to each other in this manner, confusion, ambiguity, and complexity emerged. And in contrast to, I think, a lot of times when adults are talking to teens, we provide the right answer right away, and they don't have that space to really define the problem and let all the complexity come forth. And that's something that can happen in peer group environments. And girls also expressed a desire for what Bay Chang calls an evocative relationship with adults. So not a one-way flow of information, but adults listening and learning as well as teaching and sharing. And here's a quote from her that encapsulates that a little bit more. What are evocative relationships? Positive, healthy sexuality is not something that can be instilled in or delivered to girls. It is something that they cultivate and produce for themselves over the course of education, experience, contemplation, and conversation. So maybe not the way that we normally think about sex ed and service delivery. And then here's something else that she says about sexual exploration that I think is really interesting. It's an analogy, and she points out that for infants, we don't teach them to crawl or walk by moving their limbs for them, even though in some ways that would be easier. They're very inefficient when they're learning how to crawl, but obviously it's something that they have to do for themselves. We do want to minimize risk, and so the authors go on to say here, if crawling is unsafe because the floor is dirty or littered with broken glass, the appropriate response is not to confine and restrict the child from crawling, but to clean up the mess. And I think it's a little bit challenging to think about what that would mean, cleaning up the mess in the context of sexuality, in particular adolescent sexuality, in a world where there are a lot of risks and dangers. But I think that that's a really useful thing for us to do. And then finally, I want to end with one last example. John Stoltenberg, who is a playwright and essayist, has some essays on sexuality that I have enjoyed for years and assigned to my classes. And one in particular is an essay called What is Good Sex? From this book, Refusing to Be a Man. And Stoltenberg points out that this is essentially a philosophical question, meaning that it is important and profound, perhaps unanswerable, but one that demands we meet it with all our powers of imagination and comprehension. And in the philosophical sense, this could be a question either of aesthetics or ethics. Good sex could be good because it is aesthetically good. It is beautiful, it is pleasing to the senses, it's pleasurable. Or it could be good in an ethical sense. That is, an enactment of ethical values that we hold, such as respect, justice, equality, empathy. And his answer, and I would agree with him, is that good sex has to be both. It has to be aesthetically good, but it has to be ethically good as well. And so that leads then to this question, which is one that we need to answer. What is the relationship between pleasurable sensation and principled action? This is a political question. It requires that we think about power differences. Good sex does not reinforce power imbalances, rather it repudiates them. That's good in the ethical sense. In order to do this, intimacy, trust, and fairness are key. Sex is not separate from the rest of life. And in this essay, Stoltenberg has a very eloquent way of writing about authenticity and pointing out that so many of us in our sexuality enact scripts that somebody else wrote for us. We follow our lines, we get upset when our partners don't follow theirs. And instead, there is this possibility for something that's much more authentic, that's created just for us, uniquely, in the moment with another person. And I'll close with two quotes from him. Stoltenberg's definition, description of an authentic erotic potential, which I think perhaps could be one definition of holistic sexual health. He says, "Let's assume that there exists an authentic erotic potential between humans such that mutuality, reciprocity, fairness, deep communication and affection, total body integrity for both partners, and equal capacity for choice making and decision making are merged with robust physical pleasure, intense sensation, and brimming over expressiveness." And then how do we get there? He says, "We need to begin to understand more about what is going on between us when we have sex, the values in it, how it is related to the rest of our lives, how it is related to how we treat people, and how it is related to political change. And we need to talk about it all, face to face, one to one, before, during, and after. Our bodies have learned many lies. If we can dare to be ruthlessly honest, we can perhaps recover truth." Thank you.